From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Judge Samuel Alito is well on his way now to the U.S. Supreme Court. His Senate hearings have wrapped up. His confirmation appears all but certain. Democrats appear to have backed off of earlier threats of a filibuster to block the conservative judge, though last night they did exercise their right to push the Judiciary Committee's vote to next week. With John Roberts now Chief Justice and Alito on the way, George W. Bush and a Republican Congress have had a monumental impact on the court. Judge Alito, who would replace the swing voter Sandra Day O'Connor, has been compared to Justice Antonin Scalia, a tough conservative. We'll be seeing the new court in action soon on major issues, abortion, the death penalty, election campaigns, and the environment, and for decades as it frames and reframes American life. This hour on Point, Sam Alito's America and the implications of this new justice on the bench. You can join the conversation. Are you cheering or moaning? And what do you expect from Sam Alito on the high court? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me first from Washington is reporter Charles Babington. He's been following Judge Samuel Alito's confirmation hearings for The Washington Post. Charles Babington, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
The Democrats appear to have essentially stood down here. No filibuster, as far as we know, in the works. What's the political calculus or the reading of the hearings that has led them to this path?
Well, first of all, I think there was never a consensus within the Democratic caucus of whether to filibuster. Some were inclined that way. Some from the very beginning were inclined not to.
Fair enough, right.
Yes. But I think the feeling, whatever momentum there might have been for it, a lot of it was lost last week during the hearing because there was a sense that Alito handled himself well, perhaps very well, and that he did not make any significant misstep, did not lose his composure. Maybe he wasn't quite as glib or smooth as John Roberts, but he was certainly good enough to make it very difficult to make a case that there's an extraordinary circumstance here or that he's way out of the mainstream. So I think that the Democrats feel like it would be almost impossible to sustain a filibuster. So they'll meet tomorrow and decide whether to even try it. I doubt that they will.
Is composure the measurement here, Charles Babington? Is that how Washington looks at these Senate hearings, whether or not a nominee keeps his composure?
No, not really, but I think when it's sort of yours to lose, you know, then it's going to take some extraordinary event to lose it, and that might have been one. I mean, look, he might have lost his composure and still have been confirmed, but what I'm saying is that since he was ahead of the game, all he had to do was sort of run out the clock without losing the ball, and I think everyone senses that he did that.
And what about the Democrats' longer-term political calculus here? You write yesterday that they've decided that going to the mat on the courts, on the high court, is not a winning proposition politically. They have other fish to fry.
They've been very frustrated, Tom, by poll results that show that in general, the public either generally likes someone like Sam Alito or is not terribly bothered by him. Now, obviously, a lot of liberals and liberal activists who are very important to the Democratic Party oppose him very strongly, and the issue is not going to go away. It's not as though they're never going to raise this issue, but what they think is that, partly based on polls and other things, that probably right now their best issue going into this year's congressional elections is the question of ethics. You know, their opportunities are there because of the Jack Abramoff situation, the Tom DeLay situation. They feel like that's their best opportunity.
Let's turn to the Republicans. What's your reading, Charles Babington, of what they feel they have now all but accomplished with John Roberts on the bench as Chief Justice and Samuel Alito apparently on his way? How are Republicans sizing up this shift?
As a major victory and one that in some ways is much needed and much wanted, even though the Republicans, of course, control the House, Senate, and White House, in many ways they've been frustrated, most notably by the effort, the president's effort anyway, to revamp Social Security last year. It just went nowhere. That was very frustrating to the White House. And now, of course, Republicans are in both houses of Congress are concerned about the possible fallout from the Jack Abramoff situation, Scooter Libby, and that sort of thing. So in both cases of Roberts and, barring some unforeseen disaster, Alito, these are real bright spots for the White House and the Republican Congress that they can look to with some pride.
And what's your sense, Charles Babington, of how much and how soon Republicans are expecting from a changed court?
Well, you know, I guess fairly soon, assuming that Alito is confirmed by the full Senate by the end of this month, and that seems to be the schedule, he would be seated quite quickly, I assume, to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, and could begin hearing cases right away. And, of course, Roberts is already hearing cases. But obviously, the real potential for change, as you noted at the outset, is the switch of Alito for O'Connor. So I suppose you could see potentially significant votes, certainly by the end of this spring term.
Charles Babington, thanks very much for the report from Washington.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Babington, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined us from the Capitol. Joining me now from Las Vegas is Goodwin Liu, professor at the University of California, Berkeley's Bolt Hall School of Law. Professor Liu testified last week about Alito in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Gordon Liu, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us from Williamsburg, Virginia, is Alan Meese, professor at the William and Mary School of Law. Professor Meese, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our professors.
Alan Meese, first to you, if I may. You're reading the tea leaves as well as anybody else here, and maybe better. It looks as though Sam Alito is headed on to the Supreme Court. How momentous a shift, a change, a development do you see this as being?
Well, not very momentous. I do think that in some respects, Judge Alito or Justice Alito may reach some results that conservatives are happier with than they were with Justice O'Connor. But in other areas, I think Justice O'Connor herself was quite conservative in areas like federalism, for instance, limiting the power of Congress, mm-hmm. or in property rights. And there, I think the chances are that Judge Alito would be no more conservative in that sense than Justice O'Connor was. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. And it also depends, of course, on what Chief Justice Roberts does. We don't really know what he's going to do yet. And so if he turns out to be a little to the left of Chief Justice Rehnquist, then he might end up counterbalancing any shift that Judge Alito would otherwise cause.
So a mixed bag on the conservative side. What do you see as the pluses in this mixed bag?
Well, if you're a conservative, I think it is probably the case that Justice Alito might be a little more willing to sustain some limited restrictions on abortion, ones that Justice O'Connor may not have been willing to sustain. I'm thinking, for instance, of things like parental notification legislation,
right.
or partial birth abortion regulation and things like that. What type of exceptions the state has to incorporate in that kind of legislation. So just at the margins, I think, to the extent conservatives would be happy with those developments, I think they'd be happy with Judge Alito's votes. Maybe also in a death penalty context. I think as a former prosecutor, bringing a perspective that's not really represented on the court, he may move to a sort of or be less willing, to micromanage state death penalty procedures and state death penalty statutes in the way Justice O'Connor was willing to do in some cases. Although even there, she was relatively conservative on that issue.
But that's it? After all these years of yearning and hoping and dreaming and capturing both houses of Congress and the White House and now two new Supreme Court justices, it would appear, that's it? That's the payoff for conservatives?
Well, you know, the two new justices are replacing two justices who were very conservative themselves and were, proposed by people like Barry Goldwater, right? So, you know, remember Sandra Day O'Connor endorsed Ronald Reagan in the 1970s over Gerald Ford. She's certainly no liberal. And on a lot of these issues, she is as conservative as Justice Alito would be. And of course, we know that Chief Justice Rehnquist was the conservative's conservative. And so it's hard to imagine somebody being more conservative than he is. So to some extent, President Bush is really replacing two justices of the exact sort that he would have appointed himself had he been president when they were appointed. So in that case, I think they're both excellent choices. But in terms of really moving the court in any particular direction, I think I would not predict that.
Goodwin Liu, let me put the same question to you. We've got John Roberts there. It appears that Sam Alito is on his way to the high court. How do you gauge the ramifications top level?
Well, I think that Professor Meese makes good points. I think that Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor were both very conservative justices. I do think, though, that in the areas that Professor Meese mentioned, the death penalty and abortion, I do think there are differences between what Judge Alito would be like based on his record. I just think that those are actually quite big changes in the direction of court rather than simply marginal ones. Roe, of course, is sort of the big elephant in the room, and although the hearings didn't really draw him out on it, which was pretty much as predicted, I think many people think that he doesn't consider Roe to be settled precedent. He wouldn't use that language. And that's a major difference between him and Justice O'Connor, and I think that that is the principal victory that the conservatives wanted in the appointment of a Supreme Court justice, someone who would, if not overrule Brown, at least, or not Brown, but Roe, if not overrule Roe, then someone who would be willing to hollow out that precedent case by case. And I think Justice Alito would be that kind of justice.
We're going to dig in much deeper here, but Jack Beatty, let me get your first response to what you saw last week and to what you expect from a court with John Roberts and now very likely Samuel Alito on the bench.
Well, you know, other things being equal, he'll side with corporations over employees, with the police over suspects, with the president over Congress, with the fetus over the woman, with husbands over wives, with order over liberty, and with authority over freedom. That's my general sense of him. You know, where others see racial bias, I think he's probably going to see lack of proof. Racial redistricting, affirmative action, probably no. Warrantless wiretapping, probably yes. And he has a doctrine of the unitary executive that in our context today of the war on terrorism and warrantless wiretapping and so on is a little frightening.
The way you put it, Jack, it doesn't sound marginal. We'll come back and look at it. We're talking this hour about Sam Alito's America and the implications of a Justice Alito on the Supreme Court. You can join us. It's all over, but the voting, which way do you vote on Sam Alito and why? We're at 800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Sam Alito's America and the implications of a Justice Alito on the Supreme Court. It appears to be coming. You can join the conversation. What's the vision of the country emerging in the Roberts, Alito, Scalia, Thomas court? And are you happy with it? Can President Bush go back to Crawford now? Has he delivered on his conservative promise? And with Alito's advance, is the country accepting that the right to abortion will retreat? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joined from Williamsburg, Virginia, at the College of William and Mary by Alan Meese, a law professor there, one-time law clerk for Antonin Scalia. From the California Berkeley Bolt Hall School of Law, Goodwin Liu joins us, a one-time Supreme Court clerk for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jack Beatty is with us as well. Alan Meese, let me put Jack Beatty's long laundry list to you. There, as I was saying, it doesn't sound marginal. Corporations over employees, police over suspects, president over Congress, husbands over wives, authority over freedom. Do you buy this picture of Sam Alito on the high court?
Well, it may well be true that Judge Alito prefers those results that Jack pointed out, but I only say that Justice O'Connor very often preferred the very same results. She was big business's biggest friend on the court. She led the fight, for instance, to say that the Due Process Clause limits states' ability to impose punitive damages. That's something that put her more favorable to business than Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas. She was also more favorable to the police under the Fourth Amendment than Justice Scalia has been over time. So there she was a real law and order conservative. She often favored employers as well in the civil rights context, for instance, siding with the majority. And also I'll just point out that very often there are only four votes for the sort of results that people fear. So if people fear that Roe versus Wade is going to be overruled, even if Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts would vote outright to overrule Roe, there's still five votes on the court not to do that because Justice Kennedy becomes the swing vote. And since Justice Ginsburg replaced Justice White under President Clinton, Justice White was also a sure vote to overrule Roe, but he's gone now. So, again, I think that people might be overstating to some extent the impact that Judge Alito will have as a single justice, even assuming he'll vote again to overrule Roe.
Goodwin Liu, how do you see it? Jack has thrown some issues into high relief here for us. Do you see a kind of status quo ante emerging with a Justice Alito on the bench? When Americans hear authority over freedom and on down the line, that can sound imposing depending where you're coming from, troubling. Do you see it as troubling?
Well, I think Jack's list was exactly right, actually. And I think that one indicator of the views of Judge Alito against the mainstream of American legal thought is the fact that at least in cases involving the government against the individual, if you look at very closely at his 15-year record on the bench and you look at those cases in which there were divided panels of his court, meaning cases in which the judges disagreed, and those would be the kind of controversial cases that tend to get to the Supreme Court, you know, very close contested cases, mm-hmm. he sided with the government 90% of the time, which is far more often than appeals judges nationwide, and even far more often than Republican-appointed appeals judges nationwide. And so here I think it raises serious concerns in the context of broad assertions of executive authority that we're seeing today, both with respect to things like torture and things like military commission trials for Guantanamo detainees, and also with respect to warrantless eavesdropping. I think all of those issues are very much in the foreground with respect to a justice who has a broad tendency, I think, to defer to law enforcement and executive authority. They're very troubling.
Alan Meese, you've clerked for Justice Scalia. Take us into the extent you can into conservative or really Republican thinking here. What about this charge of a justice-in-waiting favoring authority over freedom? That doesn't sound like a Republican position traditionally. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do you think that's an accurate interpretation, and how does it square with traditional conservatism?
Well, I think it's a question really that's improperly framed and viewed at too high a level of generality. There are many areas where Judge Alito has opposed the state, the free speech context, for instance, the free exercise context. He's voted also to place limits on congressional power, thereby, again, limiting the power of the state vis-a-vis the individual. He's also been criticized for not allowing enough suits on the under the environmental laws, which, again, seek to regulate individual conduct. So I think it's really a mixed bag. And I think it's also a little unfair to look at someone's record, look at only at the divided opinions. When you have the other 90% of the cases were unanimous, perhaps, it's like looking at Earl Warren's record without looking at Brown versus Board of Education because it was unanimous.
But those siding with the government 90% of the time in those cases, it does stand out as a statistic, as an indicator, does it not?
Yeah. It is a statistic, but I think it has to be compared with the other cases where the panels were unanimous, and most appellate panels are unanimous. And again, I don't think that it's fair to evaluate a judge's record by looking at only at those cases where people, one judge or more, disagreed. And I will also say that all of the judges, or most of the judges who disagreed with Judge Alito in those cases, in fact, came before the Senate last week and endorsed him. Even if they dissented from his opinion. So they at least testified he was a mainstream judge. I don't think also that conservatism believes in limited government across the board, right? I think conservatives have always believed that there is a role for the state in protecting the helpless, for instance, in law enforcement, in protecting private property, right? As Madison said, the very purpose of government is protecting the faculties of acquiring property. That requires the exercise of state power, including law enforcement. Conservatives also believe that the commander-in-chief in time of war has the authority to gather military intelligence, and that Congress cannot strip him of that power any more than they can strip him of the power to veto a bill. I don't know that how Judge Alito will come out on that particular question. I think people are confusing the unitary executive question on the one hand, which is how much can the president control the executive branch given that he has certain executive powers, with the second question, which is what executive powers does the president have to exercise? Mm-hmm. And Judge Alito tried to distinguish between these two. I think his speeches show a strong view on the first question, which is, yes, he is a unitary executive person like William Howard Taft or Justice Scalia. On the second view, I don't think we've really seen anything from him that helps us read the tea leaves on, you know, how he views this question of can Congress, you know, limit the president's authority as commander-in-chief, for instance.
Good one, Lou. Order over liberty. I mean, are we headed into a century where that is more the rule? If this judge may sit on the court for decades, if he swings us some distance in that direction, is that the future?
Well, Tom, I'd like to point out one thing, which is that I think in some ways Judge Alito is quite different than a conservative like, say, Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia is a very interesting justice because, apart from his generally conservative views, I think he also has a very strong libertarian streak to him. Mm. And libertarians tend to believe that there are some forms of government intrusion into privacy and security that they are very skeptical of. Justice Scalia, for example, ruled in a case not too long ago that the police can't use a thermal imaging device, for example, to look at the heat coming from your home. In this case, the police use that device to spot marijuana growing under a bunch of heat lamps mm-hmm. in a guy's house.
Mm-hmm.
And Justice Scalia said, no, you can't do that without a warrant. Justice Scalia also was a voice in the Hamdi case, one of the terrorism cases in 2004, saying that the government can't hold a detainee without charges. Either Congress has to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, or the government has to charge the individual with a crime. Those are the only two options available under the Constitution, or else the government has to release that person. It's hard for me to see a Justice Alito coming to those kinds of views based on his record. He, in the divided cases, again, in the controversial cases involving the Fourth Amendment, he has never sided with the individual. There are 13 such cases in his record. Every single time he sided with the government. And that, to me, signals a kind of both deference to the government and a little bit of lack of regard for individual privacy and the security of persons, both in their homes and in their individual persons. And to me, I think that is a kind of elevation of order over liberty that you don't see even in a justice like Justice Scalia.
Alan Meats, I guess I have to ask you, you clerked for Justice Scalia. Do you see a near future Justice Alito as less liberty-oriented than Scalia, less libertarian in his instincts?
Well, yes, in the Fourth Amendment context, I think Professor Liu is absolutely right that Justice Alito will be a lot more like Justice O'Connor in that context than Justice Scalia was. Justice Scalia very often was willing to side with the individual against the government in the law enforcement context. At the same time, in other contexts, for instance, on the right to privacy, I think Judge Alito said that he believed that there is a right to privacy under the Constitution. That's a very libertarian belief, and it's something that Justice Scalia has repeatedly rejected. On that libertarian axis, Justice Scalia really believes more in order, I suppose, than in liberty. But I do agree with Professor Liu that on the Fourth Amendment, we can expect Justice Alito to be more like Justice O'Connor, the justice he is replacing, than Justice Scalia.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the response of, we could ask libertarians, but let's ask Democrats here, that there have been and remain calls from some quarters kind of to the ramparts, fight this to the end, take it all the way, and yet that doesn't seem to be happening. How do you interpret the Democrats' response to this unfolding nomination?
Well, I think they have concluded that that making a stand over abortion rights, which this really would come down to, a filibuster would come down to, first of all, wouldn't be sustainable. The Southerners, the senator from Louisiana, the two senators from Arkansas, just couldn't go along with it. Ben Nelson, senator from Nebraska, he couldn't go along with it. And that's a losing proposition for them, that they're not going to make a stand over abortion rights. So you have a man who in his memos basically says, I disagree with Roe v. Wade. I have a strategy that I think we should follow. He recommended for the Reagan administration to sort of undermine it case by case, which, you could see that happening. He's on the record saying that, and yet they can't make a fight over it because I think they've just concluded, as I say, that there is general support for abortion rights, but there is concentrated opposition, and in cases like that, it's just very hard politically to be a winner. And in the last election, as we saw, there were many voters, although not as many as polls originally said, who were concerned about values and saw the Democrats as lacking values. And I think they don't want to get so intimately identified with abortion rights.
I want to turn to our callers. It's all over, but the voting. How do you see the coming, apparently, Justice Scalito? We're at 800-423-8255. Veray is calling from Baltimore. Hi, Veray. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I'm calling specifically to bring up Roe in that, as a young mother, I'm 26, I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I'm against abortion. I don't think that it is right for anyone to choose that.
All right.
But I think it's not a legislative issue. I think too many women are going to be harmed by illegal doctors and all the history that we know before, when it was illegal. And I think it's tragic that it might be overturned.
So you feel the overturning out there, you feel it coming, even though you oppose abortion personally?
Yeah, personally and religiously opposed to abortion, but speaking for the country, health, it's it's a bad thing to outlaw something. I think that women would be turning to places that they shouldn't turn instead of turning to their communities and support in that way.
Ray, we hear it. Let me put it to our guest, Goodwin Liu. What happens if we get a court that turns against Roe by a margin or by a lot? I'm looking here at, you know, public opinion surveys that show the country 65% opposing overturning Roe v. Wade, only 29% approving of that. Do you think it's possible that the court will get out of sync with national opinion, American opinion on abortion? And what happens if that happens?
Well, I don't know the extent to which the court you know, really pays attention to public opinion on an issue like this. I mean, I think that you know, the sentiments of the caller are ones that I tend to share. I think that what we'll see, as I mentioned in the beginning, is probably a gradual hollowing out of Roe. It will not be a kind of elimination of Roe in one fell swoop. I think Professor Meese makes a good point that, that Justice Kennedy still remains someone on record as seeing Roe as a precedent and a settled precedent on the court. But, you know, things change, and it's, and the current configuration, I think, certainly puts a great deal more pressure on the court and perhaps even on Justice Kennedy than a configuration that included Justice O'Connor. So I think what we'll see is an emboldening with this appointment of anti-choice forces and the bringing of litigation that gradually seeks to challenge, bit by bit, the current limitations placed on states in the regulation of abortion. And over time, we'll see that the right to abortion, will be gradually eroded.
Alan Meese, how do you see that? Justices sit for a long time, over decades. What kind of direction do you see in the court on abortion? I mean, the headlines today saying, you know, abortion is no longer the, or the anti-abortion position is now fully voiceable. It's no longer the kiss of death at all. People are talking about it fairly openly. How far do you see the turn back on abortion rights going over the course of a career like as long as Justice Alito's may be?
Well, I do agree with Professor Liu's characterization of what is likely to happen, right? Not a frontal assault on Roe itself, but various state regulations that might cut back on the right announced in Roe. I think that would be a good thing. I prefer the frontal assault, of course, but I do think we would have the gradual hollowing out of Roe. But I think you'd also have to look at things on a state-by-state basis. Your caller, for instance, is from Baltimore, Maryland. I don't think that Maryland is going to be a state that will move to limit the rights that were recognized in Roe, and you know, states like New York, California, places like that, are not going to move to take advantage of any newfound power. There will be some states, maybe some states in the South, maybe some in the Mountain West, who would move in that direction. Maybe Pennsylvania as well. So, but it really will vary on a state-by-state basis. And what happens in the long run, frankly, is going to depend on who wins the next presidential election and who, therefore, gets to replace whatever justices retire between 2008 and 2012, if you're asking for a long-run question.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, it's always easy to imagine that the status quo goes on forever, but many people are imagining it otherwise and hoping for that. Do you see sort of presumptions of the last 20 years, 30 years, radically changing in the next couple of decades?
Well, ask ourselves this question. John Paul Stevens is it 84? And I don't know what the actuarial tables are for a man that age, but in the next 3 years, is he, you know, is his health going to hold up? If it doesn't, if he has to retire, that's the fifth vote. That's the vote that could end the basic abortion right. We're, you know, one could say, well, Justice Kennedy is there, but what happens when Stevens goes and who gets to replace him? It seems to me that if this basic right can hang by one vote like that, that's saying a lot, that the precedents aren't by any means settled.
Alan Meese, Goodwin Liu, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking about Sam Alito's America. It looks like it's on the way. Listeners, you can join us. Is the country, or at least the Republican majority, accepting a more powerful government, a more powerful executive? 800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services, in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Sam Alito's America and the implications of a Justice Alito on the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join us. After all the politics and posturing and inquiry, do you feel you really know Samuel Alito? Do you like what you see? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Where would Justice Alito help take the country? 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined today from William and Mary College by law professor Alan Meese, from University of California, Berkeley, Bolt Hall School of Law by Goodwin Liu, by Jack Beatty, and right now Carol calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I want to first say that originally I was a supporter of Alito, but after listening to the hearings, I no longer support him.
Why not?
Well, basically, I think at best he's dishonest, and at worst, I think he's a racist. The reason I think this is
that's pretty heavy stuff, Carol. What have you got?
I know, and I'm kind of wondering why no one's talking about this. But I don't feel that he ever really reconciled his supposed connection between the ROTC and the concerned alumni of Princeton. And that was his only explanation for why he could have possibly been a member. So he never really went on to explain that membership. And that his affiliation with that and membership with that organization is very concerning to me.
Which leaves you wondering if he was actually opposed to minorities and women could be in greater numbers at Princeton.
Right. And furthermore, if he's just not providing an explanation, I think even if he was to explain that at that time in his life, he felt that way politically, but he's since changed, even that would be more acceptable to me than to say, I mean, not that that's acceptable.
Okay.
As long as he can prove that he's changed.
Yep.
But even that would be more acceptable than to say, I just don't recall, because I'm not buying that for a minute. That's just baloney. I can't believe that someone of his intellect and abilities can't remember why he joined a group 25 years ago.
So there's the credibility question. It was bandied around a lot. Carol, let us pick it up. Goodwin Liu, how about it? Where did you see Judge Alito ending up on the credibility front? Democrats promised to use that as a weapon against him. It didn't really catch fire. How do you see it?
Well, I certainly don't think Judge Alito can be characterized as a racist. I think that's a very serious charge, and I don't think that that's at all correct. I think that all the character witnesses who testified to his background fairly well said that this is a man who has extreme integrity in what he does, and certainly is not someone who's hostile to minorities, hostile to women, and I certainly see no grounds to question that in terms of his character. So I reject the idea that Judge Alito is a racist. I do think that the Princeton his answers to the Princeton questions were basically a little bit evasive. I think what basically happened in the Princeton incident is that he was applying for a job in 1985 to a very conservative Justice Department, and he was trying to signal his conservative credentials. And so he put down the Federalist Society and he put down the Princeton Group as kind of credentials that would suggest to people, hey, here are my conservative bona fides. And he should have just said that in the hearings. I think if he had said that, it would have been over with in one sentence, and we could have moved on to a bunch of other issues.
Jack, do you see that shading, if that's what it was, in presenting those issues from another time as within the kind of accepted and expected bounds of how a Supreme Court nominee speaks to a Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, that's getting to be the way it's done, isn't it? I mean, this kabuki theater business where, no one expects straight answers, but he was more than disingenuous there. I quite agree with our caller, not necessarily about whether he was racist or not. I don't know that. But But on this question, he just simply gave no satisfactory answer. He didn't want to look like a supplicant, somebody who played the angles to get a job in the Justice Department. So he couldn't be quite honest about that. On the other hand, this is a group that, you know, it's like being a member of a racially exclusive country club or something. And as Senator Leahy pointed out, my gosh, this kind of stuff is entirely against his own background as an Italian American. So it was extremely troubling that he had no good answer for that.
Alan Meese, Judge Alito, forthcoming enough, forthright enough?
Well, I would never compare my own intellect to that of Judge Alito, but there are certainly a lot of things that I can't recall from the 1970s and the 1980s, and I probably don't know what I can't recall. So I took his answers at face value. He said he can't remember why he joined the group, and he can't remember why he put it on a job application. I filled out a lot of job applications in my time, probably more than Judge Alito. And if you produced one tomorrow, I probably couldn't tell you why I put a certain thing on a job application. And let's remember, all the founders of this group say that Judge Alito was never involved. The documents that Senator Kennedy so loudly demanded did not mention Judge Alito once. He'd never received this magazine that everybody was talking about.
But he's not denying he was a member, that he joined.
He's not denying he was a member, but I think his story, which is I may have joined it at one time because the ROTC offices at Princeton were closed and ROTC was kicked off campus, is certainly a plausible story to me. But then, you know, certainly people join organizations and then don't keep up with them and therefore wouldn't remember, why he was still a member in 1985 or why he put on a job application. Again, that's something that happened 21 years ago, and even brilliant people like Judge Alito don't have perfect memories.
We've got so many callers waiting to get in. I want to hear from a bunch right now. Benjamin is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Benjamin. What do you think?
I think that Judge Alito is a competent individual, and it appears to me right now that the Democrats Party is more or less making a stall tactic. They're grasping for straws on what to do next, and they're just using Judge Alito as basically they're just using him. They're trying to do everything they can to draw attention away from whatever they're trying to do. And
do you have any doubt, Benjamin, that his nomination will succeed?
I believe he will be nominated, and I think he should be. It's a step in the right direction.
We got it. Benjamin, thank you very much for your call. Let's hear some more. Steve is calling from Boston. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is simple. Where does it say or who decided that the Supreme Court needs to be balanced in such that if a swing vote moderate or whatever is going off the court, that they must be required to be replaced by a similar swing vote moderate?
And how are you coming at that, Steve? Are you saying to heck with the moderation, let's go right?
No, I'm saying that sounds very political to me, like, oh, we need to be evenly balanced with liberals, moderates, and conservatives, and so we've got a system where we've reserved seats for certain people who fit certain criteria. No, that's very political. I'm looking for a competent jurist.
Are you for or against Sam Alito?
I happen to be for him, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, we've got it. Steve, let me put that to Alan Meese. Alan, what about the idea of preserving the swing vote? Is there anything that says that has to be done or should be done?
No, Tom, and I agree entirely with Steve that it's just an opportunistic argument being made here by Judge Alito's critics. Certainly FDR did not look for balance when he replaced the four horsemen of reaction who had opposed his New Deal programs. And certainly President Clinton didn't look for balance when he replaced Justice White with Justice Ginsburg. Again, it's just an argument that people make. I'm sure conservatives will make it someday in a similar situation. But the real question is, do you agree with a particular judge's judicial philosophy, his or her approach to interpreting the Constitution and applying the laws of the land? And that should be the question. And the president has a certain view. He ran on that view. He won the election. On the other hand, the senators, they all won their elections, and they too are free to ask that same question and vote up or down on a candidate based on his or her judicial philosophy.
And it looks like the president's going to get his man. Alan Meese, let me get at least one more call in here. Larry's calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I was just calling because I keep hearing you referring to this as Alito's America, and I don't necessarily agree with that viewpoint considering what the makeup of the judiciary is now.
Well, doesn't the court help shape the country over time, and doesn't Sam Alito being added to it change the chemistry?
You know, I find that the hearings themselves lack any particular substance where you can truly judge an individual. Based upon what I heard, if I took it for face value, I didn't necessarily agree with Alito, but at the same time, that I feel that the sense of balance within the court system itself is such that you'll be coming out with reasonable and responsible judiciary decisions.
Do you feel a shift in the complexion of the court? Do you feel it becoming more conservative? Has the country's become more conservative politically in the last 20 years?
I think the shift of America itself is going towards a moderate view, and I don't think that the court would do anything unnecessarily wrong in terms of shifting towards the viewpoint of the Americans.
Larry, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. We've just got a few minutes left. Gordon Liu, I want to look at this issue a little deeper of executive power. The ACLU today is saying it's going to file a lawsuit to block President Bush's domestic eavesdropping program. Where do you see Alito pushing presidential power, executive power in this country, or helping push it?
Well, that was an issue that was explored somewhat at the hearings, but not in a very clear fashion. You know, I think this is a very troubling issue for many Americans. We just learned from today's news reports in the New York Times that many of the eavesdropping activities that the NSA had engaged in were on innocent Americans. Thousands of leads produced that led to practically nothing, which means that a lot of Americans were spied on, in essence, with no connection to terrorism whatsoever. I think that Professor Meese makes an important distinction between two views of the unitary executive theory, which is something that the senators bandied about with Judge Alito in the hearings. One view is that, and I would say this is the limited view is that the president should be able to control all the officers of the executive branch. That is essentially a point about management. Management of the executive branch belongs to the president.
The machinery of government.
Exactly. The broader version of this thesis is that by implication, because the president is the sole manager of the executive branch, nobody else gets to manage the executive branch, and that just simply does not accord with the last 6 or 7 decades of our evolution of the political system. We have a system in which there are many checks and balances on the executive branch, including not only the judiciary, but very importantly, Congress. Congress passes laws that restrict what executive officials can do all the time.
Alan Meese, if I may, Gordon, I'm sorry, but we've a good one, but we've just got a moment left here. Alan Meese, in just half a minute, do you see the country heading toward a stronger executive with or without war around it?
I'm not sure there really are 5 votes for the sort of strong executive theory that Professor Liu is propounding. It may be that Justice Alito would support that, Justice Scalia. Probably not Justice Kennedy, and certainly not Justice Ginsburg, Stevens, Souter, or Breyer. Maybe Justice Thomas will leave it, I'm not sure. So you would need some more votes for that. I think he's right. It wasn't clear at the hearings exactly what the nominee's views are.
But on we forge, Jack Beatty, as you say, there may still be more such hearings before George W. Bush leaves office.
Yes, the clock is ticking, and we have to remember that it was Alito who came up with this whole idea of a presidential signing statements when he was in the Meese Justice Department, this idea that the president can give his own gloss on the law. I'll decide whether to follow it or not.
There's a kind of concentration of power, to be sure. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us this hour. Alan Meese at William & Mary and Goodwin Liu at the University of California, Berkeley's Bolt Hall School of Law. Thanks to all of you for joining us. In a moment, Al Gore on presidential power and the American judiciary. This is On Point. Yesterday in Washington, former vice president and presidential candidate Al Gore delivered a fiery and controversial speech. It was titled Restoring the Rule of Law. Gore focused on what he described as a dangerous expansion of executive power under the Bush administration and pulled no punches in his criticism of the current president and the White House admission that the NSA has been wiretapping American citizens without court order.
What we do know about this pervasive wiretapping, virtually compels the conclusion that the President of the United States has been breaking the law repeatedly and insistently.
Gore went on to deliver a critique of the administration's dealings with the other branches of government, including what he called a, quote, direct assault on the power of judges. Here's an excerpt from Gore's speech.
In a properly functioning system, the judicial branch would serve as the constitutional umpire to ensure that the branches of government observe their proper spheres of authority, observed civil liberties, adhered to the rule of law. Unfortunately, the unilateral executive has tried hard to thwart the ability of the judiciary to call balls and strikes by keeping controversies out of its hands, notably those challenging its ability to detain individuals without legal process, by appointing judges who will be deferential to its exercise of power, and by its support of assaults on the independence of the third branch. The president's decision, for example, to ignore the FISA law was a direct assault on the power of the judges who sit on that court. Congress established the FISA court precisely to be a check on executive power to wiretap. And yet, to ensure that the court could not function as a check on executive power, the president simply did not take matters to it and did not even let the court know that it was being bypassed. The president's judicial appointments are clearly designed to ensure the courts will not serve as an effective check on executive power. As we have all learned, Judge Alito is a longtime supporter of a powerful executive, a supporter of that so-called unitary executive. Whether you support his confirmation or not, and I respect the fact that some of the co-sponsors of this event do, I do not. But whatever your view, we must all agree that he will not vote as an effective check on the expansion of executive power. Likewise, Chief Justice Roberts has made plain his deference to the expansion of executive power through his support of judicial deference to executive agency rulemaking. And the administration has also supported the assault on judicial independence that has been conducted largely in Congress. That assault includes a threat by the majority in the Senate to permanently change the rules to eliminate the right of the minority to engage in extended debate of the president's nominees. The assault has extended to legislative efforts to curtail the jurisdiction of the courts in matters ranging from habeas corpus to the Pledge of Allegiance. In short, the administration has demonstrated a contempt for the judicial role and sought to evade judicial review of its actions at every turn.
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking yesterday at Constitution Hall in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.